Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And it was true that I was born in England in this lifetime. It must have been some very bad karma which I did to get reborn in a non-Buddhist country which was so cold. But because I was born in London, it prepared me for Toronto, which is also very cold. But the first thing to remind you that sometimes, you see, I still have a bald head, even in the sub-zero temperatures. You ask me, is this my winter robe? This is also my summer robe as well. Because I follow Buddhist climate control. Have you heard Buddhist climate control before? It's environmentally very sensitive and very good. It is when you are cold, you keep a warm heart. And when it's hot, you keep a cool head. And having a cool head and a warm heart, it means no matter what the temperature is outside, inside you're always just right. And it's true because, okay, it's cold outside, but then, you know, what's really bad is when you're cold towards yourself and others. You're not warm. And when you're warm to others and to yourself, you'll never feel freezing. There's always someone to warm you up with a hug. And if there's no one to warm you up with a hug, and you feel cold in your life, lonely, fed up, depressed, here's the first method to overcome depression and rejection. Now I want you all to follow me. Please put out your hands, like this. Very good. Now please bring them in. And give yourself a hug. That's how to have a warm heart. And if you do that, you don't need anyone else to do it for you. You can do that and you never feel alone, you never feel upset, depressed or upset or anything. It keeps you warm. Because this is what we mean by having right view, having wisdom. And you know it's wisdom, it is right view, if it creates good things as a result. If it creates peace, health, happiness, harmony, then you know that must be right view. But if it causes conflict, argument, loneliness, anger, then that must be wrong view. And sometimes people say, no. Only Buddhism is right view. No. Only my type of Buddhism is right view. No. Only my particular type of Buddhism is right view. All other types of Buddhism is wrong view. Does that create harmony?
No.
Exactly. A very wise young lady over there. I always remember a story which I learned from Zen Buddhism, which I adapted to real Buddhism. It was a story of the two monks arguing. They saw a flag flutter on the top of the flagpole. And one of them said, look at that flag moving. And the other monk said, the flag's not moving, the wind is moving. You know how people like to be wiser than each other? That's why they call them wise guys. So no, he said, the wind is moving. No, the flag is moving. So they went to see the master. And the master said, you're both wrong, the mind is moving. And that was the Zen master. But then they went to see the Theravada master. And the master said, you're all wrong. It's not the wind moving. It's not the flag moving. It's not the mind moving. It's your mouths are moving. Shut up. Now that's wisdom. So much disharmony comes because of this. And I've noticed in my years of being a monk that when you get old, you see old people, many things get weak. You know, their hands get very weak, their legs get very weak, they need to have a stick to walk with, their eyes are weak, they need glasses, their ears are very weak. But there's one part of an old person which gets stronger the older they get, and that's their mouth. Old people can really talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. Isn't that the case? That's why most of your politicians are old. Because they're the ones who talk too much. So wisdom is actually seeing things which can create harmony and peace in your life and in the world. So all these arguments about is Sama to the right path, Vipassana to the right path, is Mahayana, is Vajrayana, is Theravada, is Sri Lankan Buddhism, Thai Buddhism, forest tradition, city Buddhism, which is the right path? Shut up. Don't let the mouth move. Because too often, people's wisdom, they don't understand the difference between knowledge and wisdom. I told this story in the retreat. To understand what right view is, I like telling the story of the professor at the University of Toronto, who was a philosophy professor. And he also liked eating out. He loved his food. And so when he saw in the Globe newspaper, the Toronto Globe, that a new restaurant had opened up downtown Toronto, a 5-star restaurant with a chef imported from Paris in France, he quickly called up that restaurant to make a reservation. He was a bit disappointed, but he expected it. He had to wait 2 months to get a reservation in that restaurant. That's how popular it was. So having made his reservation, he waited 2 months. When it was a night that he could go out to this expensive restaurant, he dressed in a fine suit, he went to that restaurant, they had to check his ID first of all to make sure he had a reservation. He did. So the maitre d' took him inside. And you wouldn't believe the interior decoration of this magnificent restaurant. Beautiful timber and gold filigree. The lamps were just casting just the right amount of light over the oak tables, which had candlesticks made in silver, and everything was just so perfect interior decoration. And as he sat down, the waiter came. And the waiter was like some English butler, with tails of beautiful white tie, perfectly groomed, and handed him the menu. "Sir, here is the menu." And even the menu was exquisite. It was in thick parchment with calligraphy which belonged more to a museum than to a restaurant, in gold lettering. And the professor said, "Thank you." And when the waiter left, the professor then ate the menu, paid his bill, and left. Because professors don't know the difference between menus and food. Do you get the point? Oh, people argue over menus when they never ever taste the food. It was the same story I just told an hour ago. Some people are following me around wherever I go. Your groupies following probably from the previous temple to this temple. But I told this story. This is an important story, which and it adds to what is right view, what's not wrong right view. It was a story when people were asking me about this. Many temples in Bangladesh were destroyed, and I also heard that there's many Buddhist monasteries, even in Korea, have been vandalized by Christian pastors of the fundamentalist sort. And they asked me, what should be the reaction of the Buddhist community? This is serious stuff. Apparently, this temple was firebombed by Tiger some time ago.
Twice.
Be careful, because everything is usually done 3 times in Buddhism. But maybe not here. But anyway, what did you do? And so the story which I like to tell people was many years ago, not that long ago, there was a big scandal in the Islamic community. Come in, I think that's somebody trying to convert us. I'll tell you the good news about something else. And anyway, back to the story. That there was a in all the newspapers throughout the world, I'm sure you remember it, when some US Marines in Guantanamo Bay were accused of taking a copy of the Holy Quran, putting it in the toilet and flushing it to upset the prisoners there. And there were riots throughout the whole world. And so even in Australia, there was front page news. And so one journalist working in the national newspaper, they called me and they said they were doing an article about this thing which happened in Guantanamo Bay, and that they were interviewing all the religious leaders, the leaders of all the different religions in Australia, and asking them the same question. Now they came to me as the leader of the Buddhist religion in Australia, and they said they'd already asked everyone else this question, now they're asking me. They said, Ajahn Brahm, if someone took a Buddhist holy book and put it in your toilet and flushed it down, what would you be your response as leader of the Buddhist community in Australia? Without any hesitation, I said, sir, if someone took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down my toilet, my first response would be to call the plumber. If I need to use that toilet. And not only did the journalist laugh, he gave me a wonderful compliment. He said, that's the first sensible answer I've heard all day. Thank you. But then, I became more serious. And I told him, sir, as far as I'm concerned, you can flush as many Buddhist holy books down the toilet as you like. You can destroy as many Buddhist statues, blow them up, even burn down temples, my temple, this temple. You can kill as many Buddhist monks and nuns, but I will never ever allow you to destroy Buddhism. I'll never allow you to throw peace, forgiveness, compassion, serenity down my toilet. And I made the distinction, this is the right view, between the container and the contents. This temple is a container. It's what happens inside this temple is important. The books are containers. It's what they teach is important. Even the Buddha statue is a container, it's a symbol. It's what it means to you is important. The peace, the tranquility, the serenity which it gives to you. I don't know, there's many interesting anecdotes about the Buddha statue. I don't know, many of you may not know that the wartime Prime Minister of Great Britain, Winston Churchill, kept a Buddha statue by his bedside throughout the Second World War. We found this out when one of my friends was visiting England, from Australia. He had a free afternoon. He always wanted to see a castle. That's what you do when you go to England, if you haven't lived there before. Go and see a castle. And so he went to see the castle, but the castle was closed. So the host said, well, nearby is the country home of Sir Winston Churchill, a place called Chartwell. That may be open, you can go and have a look. So he said, okay, next best thing to a castle is an English country home. And as they went in the entrance, by the entrance there was this painting of a Buddha statue, a Burmese-style Buddha statue. So the monk asked, well, what's that doing here? And the curator said that was painted by Sir Winston Churchill, and it was a painting of the statue which he had by his bedside throughout the war, which gave him peace, inspiration, and got him through those very, very dark black days. And I've seen many other people have those Buddha statues in their gardens, on their desks, wherever, because what it symbolizes is really important. I'm not sure here in Canada, but in Australia, every garden, doesn't matter whether you're a pastor or if you're an imam, has a Buddha statue in it. Do they have Buddha statues in the garden centres in Toronto?
Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of them. They never have crucifixes. Actually, I know a story about that. You know, there was this one kid over in Australia, and he just couldn't do mathematics. He was always getting low grades. So his parents changed schools. A new school, still didn't do very good in mathematics. They got tutors for him, paid for all his tutors so he could do... Because mathematics is really important to do well in your school. That didn't work. And then finally, even though they were Buddhists, they sent their kid to a Catholic school. And as soon as he went to a Catholic school, his grades went up. Amazing. So they asked the kid, why is it when he went to the Catholic school the grades went up? Was it because the teachers were much better? Said no. Now, was it because he got more resources? Said no. Well, why? He said, Mum and Dad, as soon as I went into the entrance of that school, And saw that boy in there across the class side. I realised they were very serious on that math exam.
That's a really bad joke.
It's very funny. A boy nailed onto the plus sign. That's what a kid looks at the crucifix. So anyway, back to where was I? Oh yeah. Those are all symbols. They're the containers. It's the contents which are most important. And that's why, if you have the right view, stop beating each other over the head with the books. That's mistaking the contents for the container, and the container for the contents. So all the really the teachings, the symbols, the culture, what's underneath all of that? Now, what did the Buddha actually teach? What does the Buddha statue symbolize? Many people in, say, Canada, Westerners, are always confused to see all these Buddhas bowing, bowing, bowing. Do you know why we bow to a Buddha? It's because when we bow, we exercise our stomach muscles so we don't get so fat. So those of you putting on weight like me, bow, 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 bow. But no, seriously, people say they're bowing to the Buddha, but why are you doing that? Sometimes you haven't got an explanation, especially to, Canadians, Caucasians, who actually question. And it's wonderful to question. The more you question, the closer you get to the truth. So if even I was a Westerner, I didn't like bowing. Why am I bowing? Please explain it to me. Until some of the great monks told me, what you're bowing to is what that Buddha symbolizes. Not the container, but the contents. Because that's just a piece of porcelain behind you. If you go praying to it, Buddha, 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 please may I get good grades in my examination, you're wasting your time. Buddha, 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 that nice girl sitting over there, may she go out with me. You're wasting your time. Even if the Buddha could speak, he would be interested in that, so shut up. The Buddha is not something to pray to, it's a symbol. So when I bow, this is what I do when I bow to the Buddha. The first time I bow to virtue, to goodness. Because virtue has meant so much to me in my life. Being good, being trustworthy, being honest. It's so wonderful to be with honest people. People who say they're going to be here at a certain time, and they make it. Or if they can't, they will ring you up to let you know. People who say that, the goods they're going to deliver, they do deliver on time. People who you can really trust, you can leave your money with them and they won't take anything. Goodness, trust. If you have going out with a partner who you can really trust, who you know just won't play around outside of marriage, you've got a very wonderful partner, keep them. And if you're untrustworthy, you really don't deserve the person you're living with. Please be trustworthy. Please be good. It creates so much happiness. If you want a good time, then be good. So I value virtue so much. Being kind, being good, being responsible. So that's what I bow to first of all. To virtue. To goodness. Because I worship it. And every time I bow, I remember the importance of precepts. It keeps you safe. Now, I've been told in Toronto, many people who come here do not keep the five precepts. You drink alcohol. Bad Buddhists. So I'll tell you the story of what happens when you break those precepts. This was a story of the man in Sydney who went to a party one evening and decided to try and drive home. It's against the law to drive when you're drunk, or even when you have a high alcohol level. Is that the same in Toronto?
Yes.
Yeah. But how many police are on the roads? The chances of you getting caught are not that much, are they? So many people take a chance.
And this guy decided to take a chance. He drove home knowing he was over the limit. And it happens that sometimes the police do a blitz. They check one particular road. They have a roadblock. And any car going along that road will have their alcohol level checked by the breathalyzer. Is that what you have here?
Yes.
Very good. So this guy, it was not his lucky day. As he was going home, he fell into one of these police traffic traps. Every car was being tested. You can't do a U-turn. If you do a U-turn, that's an admission of guilt. So he knew he was going to get caught. He waited in line. And when it was his turn, he got out of the car, and the policeman gave him the breathalyzer. Sir, can you please breathe into this tube for me? He took the breathalyzer and was about to breathe in when there was the sound of a traffic crash. One of the cars coming along that road was going a little bit too fast, and the car in front slowed down too fast, and they had a rear-end collision. The policeman heard the sound of the two cars coming together and said to that man, "Sir, it's more important that I check this road traffic crash than check your alcohol level." He took the breathalyzer back. "Get in your car, sir, and go home." He thought, wow, I was so lucky. He literally came within 1 or 2 seconds of getting caught. But that's not the end of the story. Because the following morning, he was woken up at home with somebody persistently ringing his doorbell who wouldn't give up. So he had to get out of bed, dress quickly. He had a hangover from drinking the night before. When he opened his door, he saw 2 policemen standing outside. If you see 2 policemen outside your door, you always get a bit scared. But then he thought, "I'm not drinking now. They cannot arrest me." So he became confident. He asked the 2 policemen, "Yes, officers, what do you want?" And the officer said, "Sir, would you mind if we look in your garage?" And he thought for a few moments, "It's only my car in my garage. I'm not driving it now. There's nothing to fear." But when he opened his garage, he almost had a heart attack. Because in his garage, there was a police car. His car was missing. You guess what had happened? When they said, "Sir, get in your car and drive home," he went in the wrong car. He drove a police car home because he was drunk. And the police, they soon checked. There's an extra car, they were missing one. He's still in jail. So that's what happens when you break your precepts. That's a true story, that happened. So be careful. So I worship virtue. It keeps me safe. And so when you worship virtue, you have nothing to fear. And every time I bow, remember virtue, precepts. When I bow, I'm raising these things above me. I'm worshiping them. Which means that I give them importance. And goodness, trust, honesty become much more important in my life. And the next thing which I bow to is peace. Because my goodness, I've spent my whole life meditating. And it creates so much happiness when I get very peaceful. And it makes me so glad when you reconcile people and they live peacefully together. And so sometimes, how do we make peace in our world? There's so many conflicts. But look, we start with the people we know and we meet. There's so many arguments, even in a marriage. So how do we create peace with right view? It's very simple. I tell this story to every couple I give marriage blessings to. It's the story of the chicken and the duck. Once upon a time, there was this couple who'd just been married. And after lunch one day, they had a free afternoon, so they decided to have a walk in the park. As they were walking together, holding each other's hands, you know, I know this couple, they've been married for 30, 40 years, and he still holds his hand, the hand of his wife. I thought that was so sweet. He said, "Yes,
When we were going out, I would always hold my girlfriend's hand out of love. After 30 years of marriage, I still hold my wife's hand, but this time it's out of self-defense. Why are you laughing? It's true, isn't it? Anyway, back to the chicken and duck story. They were holding their hands, and as they were walking, they heard a sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And she said, "Oh, listen to that, darling. That's a chicken." And he said, "Pardon? That's a chicken. Didn't you hear the chicken go quack, quack?" She said, "That's not a chicken. We all know that must be a duck. Ducks go quack, quack, not chickens." She said, "No, I'm certain that is a chicken." He went quack, quack again. "There you are, it's a chicken." He said, "It can't be, it's a duck." She said, "It's a chicken." He said, "It's a duck, stupid." She said, "It's a chicken." He said, "It's a duck. D-U-C-K, duck." And she started to cry. "But it's a chicken." And then he remembered why he married her. He looked into her eyes and squeezed her hand gently and said, "Darling, I think you may be right. That is a chicken." And he went quack quack again. And she looked at him and said, "Thank you, darling." And they walked together and had a wonderful afternoon. And that night he got a cooked dinner, rather than having to go out and find something for himself. Now, in that version of the story, that was a very smart man. For two reasons. Who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? Is that important, being right? Or is being in love and having peace and harmony more important? Right view tells you no, harmony and peace is much more important than being right. So that's wisdom. When you value the important things in life, you don't have arguments, because harmony is more vital. And number two, we always think we're right. You read the sutras and say, "There, it says there, see, it says there." But you find you've got a bad translation. Just like, it may go quack quack, but it doesn't mean it's a duck. That could be a genetically modified chicken. One who grew up next to a nuclear power plant. And I've told that story many years, and you know there are such things as chickens which go quack quack. There are. Somebody sent me an article about this little chicken who grew up with some ducks. It was orphaned, and a mother duck adopted it, and my goodness, that little chicken, now it's grown up, never goes cock-a-doodle-doo, always goes quack-quack. It is a chicken, but it thinks it's a duck, and that's why it goes quack-quack. So chickens do go quack-quack. That's why we always think we're right, but sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes we just misunderstand. This is why we jump to conclusions and why we have the wrong view too often on limited information. Many years ago, I told this story. Many years ago, that there was lots of scandals, especially with monks in Thailand misbehaving with women. And there were so many scandals, I thought it was time to teach my disciples and also make a confession. And I hung my head down and I told to a packed hall that some years before I'd had some of the happiest moments in my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we embraced, we loved each other, and it was another man's wife. Straight away, my disciples, "Oh no, not Ajahn Brahm as well." And some of them even went for the door. Before I told them, yeah, it was loving moments in the arms of another man's wife.
That was my mother when I was a baby. I spent many of the most wonderful times of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. As my father's wife, my mother. I love telling that story because people jump to conclusions. Adultery, mass misbehaving. So do you understand how sometimes in limited information we jump to conclusions and get the wrong idea? That's wrong view. So give people the benefit of the doubt. If your husband comes home late, maybe he was working late. Look, sometimes it's been very lucky. Now, I've always been a very good monk. You know, I don't break my precepts. And I'm almost 40 years now. You've watched me and seen me. You know, once I was going very close to getting into big trouble. I was teaching in a prison in a city to the south of Perth called Bunbury. Had a free afternoon. So it was next to the ocean, and it was nice and warm down there. So I had a few hours to spare, so I walked. No, down the beach in the ocean and sat down to do some meditation. It was quiet, it was deserted, no one was there. About 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I went to a very nice meditation for a couple of hours. And when I came out, you know what was happening? I looked to my left and there was a 17-year-old girl with blonde hair, drop-dead gorgeous, in a bikini, sitting on my left. And I looked to my right and there was a hot redhead on the right-hand side, also in a bikini. I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? If anyone had taken a photograph of me, I would have never, ever been able to explain it. As I'm involved with two floozies by the beach. What had happened, it happened to be the last day of school for the year before they graduate and go to university. They finish their last exam. As soon as they finish their exam, it was summertime, into your bathers, bikinis, down to the beach. It's a beach culture. And two of the girls had seen me sitting so peacefully and quietly. They really were interested in Buddhism. And they wanted to ask me some questions. They were just sitting waiting for me to come out of meditation. They asked a few questions on meditation and Buddhism, but I got up and left as soon as I could. Or like this other monk. This never happened to me, but it happened to him. He was on an aircraft from Adelaide to Perth. And he happened to be sitting next to a man who was paranoid of flying. He was so scared of flying, the only way that he could relax was taking whiskey after whiskey after whiskey, which were all free in those days. So he's sitting next to the mic, asking questions, how to overcome fear, downing more and more whiskey. And it just happened, maybe because he was a bit sort of drunk, and because they hit turbulence just before they landed, he was holding a full glass of whiskey, and it fell over the monk. So the monk's robe was drenched with whiskey. And so when this monk came out of the plane, that's the story he told when he smelled like a distillery. We're not sure if it was true, but we gave him the benefit of the doubt. That's what actually happens. But give people the benefit of the doubt. Be peacemakers. Because peace is something I really, really respect. So don't make war. If someone hurts you, let it go. I said this little saying just in the Mississauga temple just this afternoon. You don't need to seek revenge when somebody hurts you. If someone hurts you, cheats you, mistreats you, you don't have to seek revenge because karma will get them anyway. Leave it to karma to look after it. Actually, I said it in Canadian language. So no need to seek revenge because karma will get the bastard anyway. Now you remember that now, don't you? And those of you who keep objecting, Ajahn Brahm says these rude words. Look in the Aranavibhanga Sutra, in the Vinaya, there you can see the Buddha said, monks, you must always teach Buddhism in the local language. Anyway, so no need to seek revenge, karma will get the bastard anyway, so you can let it go. You can make peace. No, things will turn around, they will get it eventually. So you can make peace. So that's why I bow down to peace, because I worship peace. It's so important in my life, and in the world as well. We can't have any more wars. It just destroys so much.
So I worship peace. And the third time I bow to compassion. Compassion, wisdom. I always put those two together. So when I bow, I'm worshipping those things. And because it's compassion, it solves so many problems. It creates, again, this wonderful, beautiful world of kindness and peace. For example, if you want to know an example of wisdom and how to deal with people when they especially criticize and scold you, or they spread stories about you which aren't true. Has that ever happened to you? Happened to me many times. They spread stories about you, defame you. This is what you should do. Once upon a time. Here we go again. Once upon a time, a donkey was walking in the forest. It was thinking about all sorts of donkey business, then it wasn't being very mindful. If you're mindful, it doesn't happen to you. So if you've got a donkey, teach it to be mindful, because what happened to this donkey? It was thinking about something else, and it fell into a hole in the middle of the park, in the middle of the forest. It was an old well. The donkey was lucky on two counts. First of all, there was no water in the bottom of the well, and number two, it didn't break any bones. But there was a donkey in the bottom of a well, and a donkey couldn't climb out. So the donkey knew if it stayed there forever, it would get hungry and it would die. So all the donkey could think of doing was to shout out for help. Eeyore! 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 Waiting for someone to hear him and rescue him. There was over an hour, maybe an hour and a half, when someone heard the donkey's eeyore. And it happened to be a farmer who was a very bad man. And as soon as he found out that sound was coming from the old donkey in the bottom of the well, he said, "Serves you right, stupid donkey." But then he also thought that was a very dangerous hole in the forest. Now other people could fall into it as well. So he had this idea. I know what to do. I'm going to fill that hole in with the donkey in the bottom. I'm going to kill and bury that donkey. The donkey didn't know that. But when the man got out the spade and started shoveling dirt into that well, the dirt fell over the donkey. And the donkey thought, "What's this man doing? He's not saving me." And when more shovels of dirt fell on the donkey suddenly realized what the farmer was doing. He was burying him alive.
Eeyore! Eeyore! Eeyore!
Which in donkey language means, "Stop it, you bad man." But did the man stop? No. More and more earth, doesn't matter how loud the donkey said, "Eeyore, eeyore," the man never stopped. Until eventually the donkey fell silent. The farmer thought, "I've buried that donkey already, serve him right." And so he carried on shoveling earth in, but not so fast. But was the donkey dead? No. The donkey got insight, wisdom. He knew what to do. Instead of going, "Eeyore, eeyore, eeyore, stop it, you bad man," when a shovel full of earth landed on his back, instead what he did was just shake it off, stamp it in, and the donkey was 1 centimeter higher. Another shovel full of dirt, shake it off, stamp it in, maybe. Stamp it in, and another centimeter higher. And the bad farmer never noticed donkey's ears appear on the top of the well. He never noticed donkey's head come above the well. He never noticed when a donkey was high enough that all the donkey needed to do was jump out of the well, and he bit the farmer in the back to teach him the law of karma and ran away. And the moral of that story is this: when people shovel dirt over you and they call you bad girl, cruel boy, stupid man, When they throw dirt over you, what should you do? Don't go eor, eor, eor. All you need to do when people scold you, criticize you, tell you bad things which you never did, shake it off, stamp it in, and you are a centimeter higher all the time. That's wisdom. You know, I told that to your president, President Rajapaksa. Because he got lots of criticism. He liked that story. So whenever he got criticism in the press or from overseas, he shrugged it off, stamped it in. That's why he's still president. And that's what you can do. Your wife scolds you, as she usually does. That's the duty of a wife. Don't get angry back. Shrug it off and stamp it in. It's much better. So that's wisdom. And those are the sorts of stories which arrive you, which means you don't get upset, you don't get angry, you don't have conflict, you create harmony and peace in this world. That's why I bow to it. So every time I bow, remember first time to virtue, to goodness, second time to peace, third time to wisdom or compassion. See this almighty hand. And I remember that, which means every time I bow, I'm remembering the importance of those things, they become stronger and stronger in my life. That's how I practice. So this is what we mean by the container. And the context. I always remember the context, not so much the containers. And that way, that my practice, my life becomes better and better and better. So this is an idea of what right view is. And that right view, you can see you hear it from me, you practice it, it works. You have to make it your view, not like the professor. Now, reading the menus, studying all the Buddhism, being expert in Pali, being able to recite all the suttas and the Abhidharma, being a scholar, being an expert, but have no idea what it really means. That's just like spending your life reading the travelogues of the Lonely Planet of Perth, Australia, but never coming to visit me. It's the third or fourth time I've come to visit you, it's now your turn. But reading about it is not the same as coming there. So the most important thing in Buddhism is your experience. Because it's the experience gives you what really is right view. Too many people, they discuss and argue amazing things like enlightenment, like nirvana. And it's just like people, they're talking about things they've never seen before, they never understood before. Like you talking about quantum physics. At least I've been trained in quantum physics, so I know what I'm talking about. It's amazing just how many people talk to me about Buddhism and they haven't got a clue what they're talking about. So please, if you want right view, you've got to actually do something. Keep your precepts. You'll find, yes, what Ajahn Mok says is true. It is much more fun and much more peace. Keeping your precepts. It is much more fun being peaceful. You do create a better world and a happier world. And that's your experience. So Buddhism is not a belief system. It's an experiential knowledge. We tell you how to find out the truth. Here it is. You follow this path. This is what you'll experience. Check it out and see. Does it work? As I say, those books which are on sale outside, my books, you can always come with a money-back guarantee. It's true. No, honestly, if you don't like the book, if it doesn't work, you read them when you're not enlightened, you may ask for your money back. Honestly, cross my heart, I mean that. You may ask for your money back. You won't get it back. You aren't allowed to ask. I'm a tricky monk. So, but many of you come here because you're Buddhist. You want to say, what's the real life view? What's the meaning of life? The understanding of the essence of the universe. What is the meaning of life? Do you want to know? Would you understand? If I really told you, would you believe me? No, you won't. There's a waste of time me telling you. Because people just believe what they're told. They're stupid, aren't they? People believe anything these days. Actually, not even these days, even those days.
talking about superstition. You know, we have these stuff, so we do Pyrrhic chanting. Does that work? Holy thread, does that work? Do you have holy water here? You have holy water?
Yeah.
Holy water, does that work? I'll tell you a holy water story from the time of the Buddha. This is a true story which you can read in the 8th Pajitya for the bhikkhunis, for the nuns. In those days, the nuns' monasteries would be on the edge of the city for protection. And they didn't have plumbing like we have these days. They didn't have sewers. The toilets would just be a bucket. And it was one nun's job to empty the buckets every morning, first thing. And there was a place, you know, the usual place, designated spot where they throw the waste from the night before. But one morning, this bhikkhuni, she was a bit lazy, decided to take a shortcut, so she threw the bucket of shit over the monastery wall. And it just happened that morning, there was a man on the other side. And he was a businessman on the way to the palace to discuss a business proposition with the king. Now when you go and see the king, or like Queen Elizabeth, or the Prime Minister of Canada, you know, you usually dress up. You don't just wear old jeans and a t-shirt and an old jacket. You wear your best suit. And that's how he was. His best suit, nicely groomed, on his way to the palace. Now, I don't know what he was thinking about when he was beforehand, but after he had a bucket of shit on his head, he forgot all about that. And he was very, very upset, as you can imagine you would be. So he forgot about going to the palace. He took one of these torches, his sticks were alight, which were used as like lights in the early morning to find your way through town. He took one of those from the holder. I'm going to burn down this monastery. These aren't real Buddhist nuns. These are just prostitutes, hookers, bad women. Look what they've done to me. I'm not going to stand. I'm going to burn down their monastery. He was very angry. And as he was going into the monastery to burn it all down, he saw a layman just coming out. And the layman said, "What's happened to you?" "Look what they did to me. I got a bucket of shit on my head when I was about to go to the palace. They come and this is terrible." And that man said, "Wow, that's awesome. That's wicked. You are so lucky. You mean you got a bucket of such holy stuff for one of these first-aid guns? Now that is really unique. Something wonderful is going to happen to you today for sure. That is so auspicious and lucky." And the guy said, "Really? It is. You know, that's why we call it holy shit." And he said, "Look, listen. Go back home, get washed and changed. Something wonderful is going to happen to you today." You know, some people are so gullible they believe that rubbish. He did. Lucky for the nuns. He went home, got changed, washed, he went back to the palace. His contract was accepted and it was incredibly lucrative. So after that experience, he went, as business people do, telling their friends, "Look guys, if you really want to do well in business, forget the ordinary water, go for the number one. That's the best blessing. It worked for me." So when the word got around and the Buddha heard it, "Come over here, nuns. You were very, very lucky. You had this guy who should have been a politician, you can sell anything, who sold the idea that, you know, feces from a nun is holy. And because of that, he said, you're very lucky, but don't do that again. And if you look in the Bhikkhuni Vinaya, this is the list of monastic rules, 311 rules for bhikkhunis. The 8th rule of the Pajitya is, you shall not throw a bucket of shit over the monastery wall." And that is there today. Look it up, it's there. So you can see just how gullible people are. That's not wisdom at all, is it? So please, use your common sense and be wise. Have right view, which is very peaceful, very calm and very wise.
Otherwise, Buddhism would be looked at in a place like Canada, just another empty ritual. Just another old tradition whose use by date is gone. Something, a relic of the past rather than something which is relevant to our modern world. And of course it is very relevant. So please, get the real right view, the essence of Buddhism. And that essence of Buddhism is again, virtue, peace and compassion. This is the this is the contents. So it's a waste of time just following the containers and coming up and having Panchasila, Buddhang Samangachami. This is what happened when I went to Thailand. After many years in Australia, I went to Thailand and saw these people taking the Panchasila, the five precepts. Usually put your hands up like this, but this one man had a finger down. And I'd never seen that before. A new tradition. I said, what does that mean, having one finger down? He said, because today, Venerable Sir, I'm only keeping four precepts. He chanted all five, but one finger down meant you weren't keeping that one. And of course, I had a look, and sure enough, I saw one person with two fingers down. He was only keeping three precepts. Now that's missing the point, isn't it? Or like I've seen in some Sri Lankan temples in Australia, on Poya Day, do you keep eight precepts on Poya Day here?
Yes.
Eight precepts. In Australia temples, they keep 13 precepts on Poya Day. Have you heard about the 13 precepts on Poya Day? You keep eight precepts up to lunch and five precepts in the afternoon. Well, it's cheating! Because the eight precepts means you don't eat anything in the afternoon, but you only make that resolution in the morning. And then you change your lifestyle. That's called the 13 precepts. That's missing the point. Don't do things like that. Make it really serious. And it's fun. I keep my precepts. I'm a good meditator. I go around the world. Am I having fun? Am I a happy monk? I teach by example, and I keep my rules and precepts. So do you want to be like me? You want to be like me? Make sure you keep all your precepts. You make peace and you're wise and compassionate. It means you're happy. Do you want to be happy? This is the way to do it. I must admit though, you see I am putting on weight. But I'm not worried about putting on weight because I did some research. And the research showed me this. This is medical research. That if you laugh a lot and are very happy, every time you laugh or smile in a good mood, your blood vessels expand, they get wider. Every time you're angry or miserable, your blood vessels contract and get very thin. So because I laugh a lot, because I'm very happy, my blood vessels are like superhighways. They're so wide. So it doesn't matter about the cholesterol and other gut which goes in, they're so wide it never gets caught. But if you're miserable, your blood vessels are so narrow that even a small amount of cholesterol, you get heart attack or stroke, you die. That explains an important thing which I've noticed in life. Have you ever noticed fat people are always happy and jolly? Why is that? Santa Claus, ho ho ho. And the reason is because the fat miserable people, they died a long time ago. It's a double whammy. They're fat, extra cholesterol, thin arteries, of course they're going to go. It's natural selection, that's all. The only fat people left are the happy ones. So those of you putting on weight, who don't want to give up eating the things you like, you better start laughing quickly, otherwise you're going to die. So that's being wise. But the real right view, before I get into trouble by missing my subject, the real right view is learning how to be at peace. Learning how to let go of things. How many of you are worried about the future? December 21st, 2012 is the end of the world, people told me. But then, look, you're all Buddhists. Is it 2012 in the Buddhist era? No, it's actually 2555. 2012, we've been there, done that, we're okay. It's only the Christians who are going to die. On December 21st this year. So you guys are okay. And anyway, when I was asked this question in Indonesia,
It got on the main newspaper, Compass Magazine, on page 3 or something. Because even though it's an Indonesian, a totally different language, I said, look, I know Thai, I know a bit of Sinhala, but not much. But my second language was Thai. And the word for the Thai word for 5 is Ha. That's number 5, is Ha. So this year, 2,555 in the Buddhist era, in Thai is 2 Ha Ha Ha. It's a very funny year. And that's very auspicious. So welcome to the year, 2 Ha Ha Ha. And that was printed in the Compass newspaper in Indonesia, nationwide. They like that one. So why are you worried about it? What are you worried about anyway? I remember as a kid learning how not to worry. Do you like going to the dentist? Maybe these days it's okay. They've got high-tech instruments. In those days, when I was born, 1951, 6 or 7, 1958, going to the dentist was about equal to going to the torture chamber in Guantanamo Bay. Slow drill, and it hurt. And I was only about 6 or 7 years of age. My mummy told me, tomorrow, darling, you have to go to the dentist. I said, no way, I'm not going. You have to. No, I don't want to. You must. Even though it's amazing how kids know psychology. And said, mummy, you don't love me. I do love you, you have to go. These days, you call a child lawyer. For child abuse, taking you to the dentist when you don't want to go. But you know, that night, I hardly slept. Even as a 6 or 7 year old, I was so worried about going to the dentist the next day. And I tried again in the morning, screaming and crying, but my mother dragged me to that dentist. It was so much suffering just even thinking about it. When I arrived at the dentist surgery, only then did I find out that my appointment was cancelled. All that worry for nothing. And that was the first time I realized what we are afraid of, all those things we worry about, never happen. It's usually something much worse. No, it's not. You don't worry about it. When you forget about the future, or rather you have a wonderful attitude towards the future. Another story. Once upon a time, there was a king out hunting. And as he was hunting some animal or other, he cut his finger on a branch of a tree. There was a doctor in the entourage on the hunt. So he called the doctor over. Look at my finger, it's cut. And the doctor, not like, you know, the doctor's the Lankan doctor, this is another doctor. He just had a look at it and put a band-aid on it. And the king said, is that going to be okay? And the doctor answered, good, bad, who knows? At least he's being honest, because you can't predict how a wound is going to happen. Good, bad, who knows? It wasn't very reassuring, but there were many other animals he had to chase. So the king went off on his hunt and carried on. When he got back to the palace, the finger was infected. So he had to call the doctor over again. Look, it's got worse. Yeah, it has, Your Majesty. So the doctor did a proper clean-up of the wound, put on some ointment, a real bandage. And when he finished, the king asked, is it going to be okay now? You know what the doctor said? Good, bad, who knows? Again, it wasn't very reassuring. And sure enough, 3 days later, the wound was so infected, the doctor had to amputate it. The king was not amused, as they say in royalty. He was not happy at all. So he threw that doctor into the prison, locking the cell door himself. You stupid doctor. You should know better than that. All this good, bad, who knows business. He said, what do you think about being in jail then? And the doctor said, being in jail, Your Majesty? Good, bad, who knows? That's a crazy doctor. Why do they employ him anyway? And the king went away. A few weeks later, when the wound was healed, the king was out hunting again. And this time he was following some animal in the forest, got separated from the rest of his party, and got totally lost in the forest. As he was wandering around in the forest, he got captured by the indigenous forest tribe. Because that day was their holy day, and they wanted to make a sacrifice, a human sacrifice for their God. And what better sacrifice than a king? Just like you Sri Lankans people, when you come and give dana to the monks, you always want to give the very best, I hope. So what better gift to give to our God than a king? So they took him to the clearing in the middle of the jungle. They tied him to a tree. They started their ceremony, dancing up and down, making loud noise. And the priest came up with a ceremonial knife and was just about to split the king's throat, and someone said, "Stop it, stop it! That man has only got 9 fingers. He's imperfect. We can't offer a faulty model to our king. Release him." So they had to let the king go. And the king realized that losing his finger had saved his life. And he realized the great wisdom of that doctor. The king thought losing a finger was bad, but actually it turned out to save his life. So as soon as he got back to the palace, he went straight down to the prison to release the good doctor and apologized. He said, "Look, I didn't realize how wise you were. I look at something happening and I think it's going to be bad for my future." But you were right, good, bad, we don't know in the future, no matter what happens. "But it's a bad thing I did putting you in prison, I'm sorry." "What do you mean," said the doctor, "a bad thing that you put me in jail? Didn't I tell you, good, bad, who knows, being in jail? It turned out it was a good thing you put me in jail. If I hadn't been in this cell, I would have been on that hunt with you. I would have been captured and I've got 10 fingers. So you don't know how the future's going to work out. So if you lose your job, don't say, "Oh, bad thing happened to me today, I've lost my job." No, good, bad, who knows? If your boyfriend dumps you, is that bad? Good, bad, who knows? You may have this rich boyfriend just waiting for you, just waiting for you. Well, just like me, you know, my girlfriend dumped me when I was 19. I was so sad I got dumped. I thought it was very bad. No, no, it was good. If she hadn't dumped me, I'd have never become a monk. So, all you young ones, next time you have a separation, when it doesn't work out, never think, "Oh, what a bad thing it is. My relationship has stopped." Always remember, good, bad, who knows? With that attitude, you've got nothing else to worry about in life. You get cancer? Good, bad, who knows? You die young? Is that good or bad? Good, bad, who knows? You just go to heaven early. Sri Lanka loses a cricket? Is that good or bad? Come on, who knows? So what that attitude does, it gives you right view. The future is totally uncertain, so you don't even worry about it. You try your very best, whatever happens, good, bad, who knows? That stops a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear. And that's the past. All that stuff which people keep hanging on to in the past. I told this at Mr. Soka Temple, whatever, however it's pronounced, it's getting late now for me. This is how to overcome all the negativity, the guilt, the terrible things which happened to you in your past. I developed this story, taught it to psychologists. I taught it last night at the psychology class at the University of Toronto. And nearly, there are hundreds of psychologists, professional psychologists, clinical psychologists in Australia who are using this now. It came from me. If you have got some bad stuff from your past, things people have hurt you, you've had some bad traumas, or you've done bad things to others you feel ashamed of, it's psychology, Buddhist psychology, Western psychology, in order to deal with it, you've got to be honest with it, you've got to acknowledge it, bring it up to the surface, stop hiding it, stop being in denial. And one of the best ways of doing that is to write it on a piece of paper. Because when you're writing on a piece of paper, clearly, neatly, you're bringing it up, acknowledging it. Now that is standard psychology. Where I add the Buddhist slant to this psychology technique is recommending the type of paper you write these bad things that have happened to you on. Don't write this on ordinary paper. You must write it on that type of paper we call toilet paper and write it in brown ink. So all the terrible things which have happened to you or the bad things you've done to others, you write it on a piece of toilet paper in brown ink. Because psychologically, that gives you the association with the other stuff which usually goes on toilet paper. Now, when you've got a brown piece of toilet paper, what do you do with that? Do you ever put it in your bag or in your pocket and keep it? Not even in times of difficulty, like even after the global financial crisis. I know that some firms, to save money, ask their workers to use both sides of the toilet paper to save costs. But I think that's going... Have we got enough money in this temple? Maybe you can ask the people who come here, please use both sides. But after you don't put it in your pocket. So the association with writing all these bad things which have happened to you on a piece of brown ink on toilet paper, this is an association that this is not stuff you should keep. Stop hanging on to it. Stop clinging to it. Year after year after year. And instead, you write it on the toilet paper, then you read it, you're associating it with shitty stuff, and then you do the letting go ceremony. You take it to the place where brown toilet paper belongs. The toilet bowl. And then you pour all this past terrible stuff which has happened to you in the bowl. And then you do the letting go ceremony. You press the button. And it all goes down the hole. And with it, bye-bye to the pain of my past. That is the way to let go of the past. And you get so much peace and happiness as a result. Many of the toilets in Australia are now blocked. So please don't do it here. Do it in your home. Because you've got so much stuff. You've got to get the cup. But you know, seriously, I was making it sound funny so you can remember it. But it actually works. It's something which is very powerful because the associations are there. You put it down there, and when you associate, this is not the sort of stuff which you should keep. You do a ceremony, wash it, go away, and that helps you let go of the pain of the past, so you can be free. That is right for you. It creates peace in your life, so you're not clinging on to the stuff which maybe your wife did or your husband did years ago, which is like a cancer which eats at your marriage. You're not remembering the stuff which the Tigers did or which the Sri Lankan troops did or somebody else did years ago. That is a cancer which ruins the harmony of the country. You let things go. Flush it away. So you can be in the present moment and build a happy future. Where is the future made? When is the only time you can do anything about the future? Right now. So those of you who keep living in the past, seeking revenge, seeking retribution, whatever it is, you are missing the place the future is being made. You're neglecting the future. All of those who are worried about what might happen next, you're so far ahead of yourself, you're not looking at the place where the future is being made right now. So whatever you're doing, this moment, right now, whatever that is, whenever that is, please be good, make peace, be kind, and then you're making the best possible future for yourselves and others. That is right view. This is not intellectual, not saying the right view to be a screen winner, not saying the right view and the wrong view, and who's got the right view and who's got the wrong view. In my monastery we have the first two rules of our monastery, where I'm the abbot. The first rule is the abbot is always right. The second rule is when he's wrong, go back to rule number one. That gets a lot of peace of heart. It's only a joke, we don't actually do that. But you can see, the only one thinks they're right. I've got right view, you've got wrong view. Remember the chicken and the duck. Harmony is right view, not being right, being correct. Is the flag moving? Is the wind moving? Your mouths are moving. Shut up, you talk too much. That's not right for you. Talking so much you create a lot of difficulties for each other in life. Remember, the right view is things like, you know, when things go bad for you, stop complaining, going Eeyore, Eeyore. Stamp it in, you get higher. You become free that way. You know,
my view is not just I'm worrying about the future, it's knowing good, bad, who knows. You're making karma, it's amazing what you can make. Nelson Mandela being in jail for 26 years, was that good, bad? It made him as a human being. And that's why we look up to him as one of the inspirational models of our modern world. You think it's a terrible thing to happen to a person, but he turned into something wonderful. Good, bad, who knows? If you understand that, you have right view and living a wonderful life. Okay, I've already gone on far too long because now is the time for questions, comments or complaints. So we've got a microphone, we have a few questions for those of you who can stay a little bit longer. Actually, you can't get out anyway because it's a traffic jam at the front there. And anyway, to raise funds, you know there's never any entrance fee? We never charge entrance fee to come to Buddhist court, but there's always an exit fee if you leave too early. Okay, who's going to ask the first question?
Over there.
Over there, yes?
We don't have mics.
No, I'll repeat it. Yes.
Hello,
is that the question?
Let me get started. I'm part of the Buddhist Youth Council.
You're part of the Buddhist Youth Council? Yes.
An issue I've been trying to engage you.
Trying to engage you?
How do you mostly do that, especially in
very easy.
Yeah.
I remember a time when I just landed in Singapore. There was a youth camp. They wanted me to teach Buddhism to them, so I got down to the core because the youth, they're not interested in dependent origination or the nature of Nibbana. I split the group into two, the girls and the boys, and I looked for the girls and said, what would you like in a boyfriend? You know, the boys were really listening hard. Because, you know, I grew up as a boy. And one thing they never told me, what am I supposed to do to get a girlfriend? No one ever told me that. You know, you ask your friends, they were stupid as you were. Be tough. Get a big motorbike. That really impresses the girls. Be like Bruce Willis. That's why I got a ball kick. And when you ask the girls, they never turn them on at all. When I ask the girls discuss what they really liked in a boyfriend was someone they could trust, someone they could rely on, someone was fun to be with, who was well groomed, who wasn't so dirty and sort of unkempt, and they could have fun with. And you know, it wasn't just expensive clothes, that was not important for them. Or being tough and being manly, that didn't really turn them on at all. What really turned them on was keeping precepts. Being honest, being kind, not getting drunk, then being stupid. That was a real turn on for the girls. And when the boys heard that, they realised, hey guys, if we keep our precepts, we become very attractive to the girls. Then I asked the boys, what do you like in girls? What type of girlfriend would you like? And surprisingly, they didn't say they have to be drop-dead gorgeous. You don't have to wear expensive clothes. You don't have to wear the fashion which kills you. I remember going to Melbourne during the winter time when the fashion was halter tops. They had low-slung jeans that revealed their midriff and their navel. And the top part was just under their breast, so they had this whole swathe of exposed skin which went blue. It was so cold, I felt so sorry for them. What you girls have to do to be attractive, you know, it's just really not fair. You have to, on high heels, I don't know how you can ever walk in those. But you think that's what you have to do to be attractive. Now the boys are actually telling you, well, what do you really want in a girl? And they said, someone we can trust, someone who's fun to be with, someone who's kind. And they girls realised that they were keeping five pieces and being compassionate, and that was a great way to keep the boys. And so when the girls and boys heard this, I just taught them the meaning of the five precepts, couched in what they were really interested in life, each other. That's how you engage people. You know, you talk at their level what they're really interested in. In business, we tell them investment. That's what people are interested in. If you want to engage business people, teach them how to make more money. And that's very easy for a monk. I'll teach them, look, if you want to make more money, the simile of the holding the grass, how heavy is my grass? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels.
After 1 minute, I'm in aching. After 2 minutes, I'm in pain. After 5 minutes, I'm in agony and a very stupid muck. What should I do when it starts to get too heavy to bear? Put it down for a few seconds. 10, 20 seconds is all you need. And after 10 or 20 seconds, when your arm is rested, you pick it up again, it's easy to handle. I'm told that at the World Computer Conference, where I gave a keynote 2 years ago, from there it went to the Australian, the national newspaper of Australia. From there it went on to the Australian Stock Exchange, and about 6 months ago, it was on Harvard Business School blog. Advice for modern business on how to deal with stress. Stress has got nothing to do with how much water is in your cup, how much busyness and responsibilities you have. Stress has anything to do when it gets too heavy to bear, not knowing how to put it down. You don't throw it away, you put it down for 5-10 minutes. When you pick up your responsibilities and duties, your work again, you're refreshed, energized, relaxed, which means your brain can work efficiently once again. In other words, stress is not making the most efficient use of the human brain. It's tired, you keep pushing, which means your output is low quality and low quantity too. What will usually take 2 hours takes 4 hours, and it's not good work. Rest, half an hour's rest at lunchtime, Harvard Business School blog said, is an investment for the afternoon. You invest half an hour of rest and you get it back with greater productivity in the afternoon with interest. They call it investment. So it's using the right language to get the right people to listen to. If you're talking to kids, relationships, boys and girls, doing well at university or school, talk please at their level. Don't talk, well, dependent origination is Awija is the cause of the sankharas, and the sankharas is the cause of rebirth consciousness, and rebirth consciousness is according to the Abhidharma. Look, they've already turned off. Please take Buddhism, it's a great teaching, and repackage it to the modern audience. So that's why all these Buddhist teachings go on Harvard Business School blog. All the teachings of what girls and boys want. Look, this is an advice I've given you. If you really want a good relationship, you want someone to share your life with and be happy, please never ever marry a rich guy. If you marry a rich guy, later on in life he can afford a mistress. If he's poor, you'll never be able to do that. You're safe and have nothing to worry about. Guys, young guys, never marry a beautiful girl. If she's a drop-dead gorgeous hot chick, she'll be attractive to other guys and you'll always be jealous. But if you marry an ugly girl, she's yours for life with nothing to worry about. Doesn't that make sense? But she's going to get ugly anyway by the time she's 40 or 50. So, and when I said that, all the ugly girls said, "Sadhu, sadhu," all the four of us, thank you, I want to be a Buddhist. Yeah, so never marry a rich guy, okay? Marry a poor one, and then you'll be happy ever after. Don't try and be beautiful. Try me as ugly as you possibly can. You save a lot of money with expensive clothes and hairdos and Botox and goodness knows what else we use. And then when you get a guy, he'll always love you. That's Buddhist wisdom for kids. Okay. Anyway, let me go to the other questions. Another question over somewhere? This is my last day in Toronto, so if you don't ask a question, I'm going.
In the corner.
In the corner, question.
Dilini.
You got a question, yeah?
Pastor, I want to know your opinion about abortion.
Abortion. Yes. A lot of times you ask people how many of the girls here have had abortions. Don't put your hand up because it is many of you. And women who had abortions, sometimes they ask questions of a monk who's never ever been married. Why is it that it's men who say whether abortion is right or wrong? Is that really fair? the Pope, the presidents, the prime ministers, the priests, they're all males. How can you trust what they say about abortion? They don't know what they're talking about. I will never know what a woman goes through when she contemplates and even performs an abortion. It's beyond my experience, and I acknowledge that. So straight away, listen, don't follow the men. Too many people, girls especially, they think, no, men know best. They're the Pope, they're the priest, they're the monk. You should know, tell us. Please, that this is not really what we can do. What we can do is to say, according to the Buddhist teachings, before you make an important decision like that, please check you're not acting out of the four agatis. You're not acting out of personal desire, ill will, stupidity, or fear. When you're ever making a decision, those are the four things you have to contemplate. Am I doing this because this is just for me? So you have to balance. Are you doing it out of ill will, because you just don't like kids, or you don't like sort of, you know, the partner or whatever? Is it, if it's not out of personal desire or ill will, next check out of stupidity. What are the prospects of that kid surviving, you know, if it's, say, deformed? What are the prospects of finding, say, a foster home for it, or looking after yourself? Is that feasible? So do the research, but most of all, please, never act out of fear, especially fear of what other people will say. Or like in some religions, fear, you're going to go to hell and you're going to burn. That's gross, that's abusive, when people make women feel fear. Please don't act out of fear. As a Buddhist leader, when you have an abortion, you don't have an abortion, you'll always be welcome in my temple, you will be respected. You won't be criticized or abused or put in the back or put down or diminished any which way. We do not have the right to do that. You are welcome. It's the toughest decision you will ever make in your life. You make that decision either way, Aunt Lightning will be there for you afterwards. Because you know it's going to hurt, but our job is to be kind and compassionate to you. Not to criticize you or judge you. Because as a monk, I can't judge. I don't know what you've gone through. I can't know. All I know is really difficult, and my job is to support you totally. And if you do that, you're acting out of compassion and wisdom for as many people as possible. Please don't simplify this and say it's just killing a being. It's much not that at all. It's really complex. Many people are being considered. No, as far as I know, no woman ever does an abortion lightly. They think about that, they agonize over that for days, months, well, not maybe months, weeks, before they make their decision. And because they've been thinking about it, contemplating it, it's never really done heedlessly. They really think it's the best thing they can do in the circumstances. They got themselves in a difficult situation. They're trying to make the best of it. So because of that, most times it's not bad karma at all. Black and white karma sometimes. A little bit of bad, but a lot of good as well. So please do not feel guilty. That is the worst thing with abortion. It's afterwards, the culture, the religion, and the monks, we're to blame, hopefully not me, making you feel guilty. That is wrong. That is more evil than killing the baby. It's killing you. Killing your heart. By making you feel you've done something very bad and traumatize you for the rest of life. As far as that being is concerned, because we believe in rebirth, that being will come back again. It's just like, you know, if you go on an aircraft, you've got a booking to go to the United States tomorrow, that's me, and you find that Air Canada has overbooked the flight. So I go to the airport and I try and check in. They say, I'm sorry, sir, the flight's overbooked. We'll give you a flight, the next available flight. That's what happens with an abortion. The kid gets bumped off the flight into the human realm. Well, you know what happens if that occurs to you at the airport?
you get the next available flight, and you also get upgraded to business. So that kid in your womb, he gets the next available womb and also gets upgraded as well. Basically, that's what usually happens. I'm saying it in an easy, understandable way. So don't feel so bad about it. You tried your very best. You haven't been heedless. There's very few women who are heedless on abortions. I don't know anyone who's ever been that way. But I know many women have come up to me and said, "Look, I don't know, what should I do?" I tell them before I got is to consider, and then I say, "Look, I care for you so much, you've got so much metal, whatever you do, I'm there for you. I'll always treat you exactly the same before, even with more respect, no matter what you choose. Don't be afraid. You have friends who love you so much. Difficult decision, you have to make it. I can't make it for you, but I'll always support you." It's one of the issues I'm passionate about, simply because women have been treated so badly, especially by religion, because of abortion. And that is just not on it in our modern age. So that's my feeling on that. So thank you for that sort of question. Yeah? Why are we here? We've got to be somewhere, we just happen to be here. That's the first one. Why, what's the meaning of life? I said this, the meaning of life for everybody here is to support the Toronto Mahavihara. That's the purpose of your life. Now the real purpose of that is, I forget what the name was, that Maloff or Maslow or something's hierarchy of purposes. Instead of looking at this as an intellectual, theoretical level, if you are struggling to survive, survival is your main purpose of life. Just to get by, to keep your life, to look after your family, to get enough to eat. You look at anybody in disaster zones or in poor countries, in war-torn zones, their main purpose is not to become enlightened or become a sower. Their main purpose is to get through the day. If you've got cancer, you forget about everything else and just make sure that you're going to survive. So that's the hierarchy of purposes. You know, the first one is to survive. And obviously afterwards, you know, to look after your health, to educate yourself, to grow physically and sort of financially. And the next hierarchy of purposes, sometimes you get this when you're young, certainly you get you when you're old, is like, you know, what's the best contribution I can make to this world? Is where you do charity, because you want to make sure that when you die, you look back upon your life and you actually help, you've made a difference, you've served, you've done something for others. You know, maybe it's just for mothers, you've raised these beautiful children. Maybe for others, you've built this beautiful temple or hospital, you've actually done something for others, that's really important. But then the highest of those hierarchy of purposes is actually find out the last question, the real meaning of life, why are we here? That's much, much deeper. Find out exactly who you are. And that becomes the highest purpose in life. Not why we're here, but who is this person we're asking, you know, we is. Who am I? What is this? And that's the highest purpose in life, because if you don't know who you are, all the other questions become meaningless. So your question, your purpose is to find out who asked that question. And you never find that out through thinking, because thinking goes around in circles. Philosophers have never been able to discover that answer. You won't find that answer from a book. With these holy books which try and tell you the answers, they make absolutely no sense, and it's only through belief. One book says one thing, one holy book says another thing. That's not the way to find out the answer. The only way to find out the answer of who you are is to contemplate the simile of the emperor. I told a simile this afternoon in another temple. Once there was an emperor who was very, very powerful, but no one knew who the emperor really was. Because every time the emperor appeared in public, the emperor was covered with five pieces of clothing, had boots which went up to the thigh, had trousers which covered the top of the boots and went up to his waist, had a jacket which overlapped the trousers with long sleeves to his wrist and a high collar,
had gloves which overlapped the sleeves of the jacket, and lastly a helmet which overlapped the top of the jacket. Every one of those five pieces of clothing overlapping each other so you couldn't see who the emperor was. Whether the emperor was a girl or a boy, whether it was old or young, whether it was Sri Lankan, Canadian, Malaysian, Singaporean, or Australian. No one knew who this powerful emperor was. And so the only way they could find out was one day, take off all the clothes of the emperor to find out what was inside. Who was the emperor? And that is a simile for you. You are the emperor. Who is the one looking at me right now? Who decided to come here this evening? Who is this one who experiences all the happiness and pain, the hopes and fears and anxieties of life? That emperor is always covered with the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. So you never actually find out this mind inside. So your job, take off the five senses. Not seeing, not hearing, not smelling, not tasting, not touching. And find out what's left. The emperor inside, the sixth sense called the mind. That's what we do in meditation. Everything vanishes. You can't feel the body. You can't hear sounds. Everything's gone. All that's left is the mind. That's what meditation is, in a nutshell. When you're face to face with that mind, you find out what it is. You find out who you really are. That's the jhana meditations. Five senses vanishing. That's what we do as Buddhists. That's why we find out who you really are. And if you want to find out, the answer will be given to you in the next meditation retreat. Please sign up. Otherwise you go through your whole life never really knowing who you really are. Okay, that's an easy question, meaning of life and why we're here. Any difficult ones? One over there, yes.
I can be really forgetful, and the more I get stressed out, the easier it is to get really overwhelmed and forgetful. So within that way, how do you bring yourself back? Because I know when you said when you meditate, you don't force something.
Relax. If you like, I will give you a certificate to give you permission to be forgetful. You don't have to remember everything. It's very difficult for me these days. I travel around the world so much and people say, do you remember me? I came to your talk in this temple 4 years ago. Thank you very much. 4 years have gone. I go to thousands of temples every year. I'm not going to remember you. So what I do, I don't want to upset people. So I said, yeah, I remember you. You're the person whose name I keep forgetting. You try that, it really works. Nathaniel H. Jones or Samantha or something. Yeah. So it is true, you get so overwhelmed that you can't have any more space in your brain to remember things. So you just let things go. The way to do that. When I first went to see my elderly mother in London after being in Australia for a few years, somebody gave me a little kangaroo, a stuffed toy kangaroo, and I gave it to my mother as a gift, so that when I returned she could remember me, her son who was in Australia, a nice little kangaroo. She loved that kangaroo, she put it on the shelf in her house. The next time I bought a kookaburra, and she loved that too, so she put it next to the kangaroo. The next time I bought a koala bear, symbol of Australia, it's a beautiful little koala with a little hat on it with corks on it. You get it in the toy shops, the tourist shops at the airport. And so I gave that to her. That was number three. And then there was a platypus, and the last one was a wombat. And by the time she got the wombat, she couldn't put it on the shelf because the shelf was already packed. And so she tried to balance it on the shelf and other things fell off. And she spent a couple of hours trying to get everything on the shelf. And I said, Mum, throw the old ones away, then you'll have space for the new ones. No, I can't. heart. I remember these things, they're important, I don't want to throw anything away. And then I realise your problem. That's what stress is, mental breakdown. You get so much stuff in your head, you've got no space for anything new. So please, throw away all the old stuff. Like on your email account. My favourite button is delete. delete. Only keep today's emails. The old ones aren't important, you never look at them again anyway. Delete them all. Then you've got so much space on your email account for new ones. Otherwise you've just got no space. So this is actually the problem. And to be able to do that, I was taught the simile of the dustbin. Because as a monk, people come up to me and ask me their questions, tell me their problems. And I was taught, you're like a counsellor. And everyone is a counsellor. Your friends come and tell you your problems. People at work tell you their problems. So you have to be like a dustbin. And people come and throw all their rubbish in you. It's not your problem. You've got enough problems for yourself. And they tell you all the other problems, which you have to try and remember. But no, take everything into your dustbin. But you must remember the trick. The most important part of being a dustbin is to make sure you've got a hole in the bottom of your dustbin. So you keep absolutely nothing. So it means people dump on you, you don't keep it, you don't try and remember it, let it all go through. So you're always empty for the next person who's talking to you. You carry nothing into the future with you. Then you'll always have space for the beauty, for the interesting things of the present moment. When you always worry about the past, when you're always anxious for the future, you're never really here, you're never really enjoying life, where it happens. So that's how not to be stressed. The Emperor's three questions. Now is the most important time. The one in front of you, or the work in front of you, is the most important. And the most important thing to do is to care. When you practice like that, now is the most important time. The one in front of you, or if you're in front of the computer, the letter, the assignment, the deal in front of you is the most important. The most important thing is to care. Then you'll find you never get stressed out. And you become highly successful in work, in life, and everything else. It's one of the sayings of Ajahn Chah. A Sydney guy went to see him, had a hard time finding him. When he got there, he was surrounded by so many people he couldn't ask his personal questions. So he, after 2 hours of waiting, he started walking away. He did actually see that the monks were sleeping in the temple. He had half an hour to spare before the taxi would come to take him back to the train station. So he picked up a broom and started sweeping. Now my master, Ajahn Chah, was so compassionate and wise. He saw that Westerner come all the way from Sydney, not to tour around Thailand, just to ask his question. So he came up to this friend, put a hand on his shoulder, and told him, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. And then he went away. And that guy, Australian guy, said that was the best spiritual advice he'd ever got in his life. And that changed him completely. He became a very successful business person, a great family man, and really happy. Because when he was at work, he gave everything he got to his work. He wasn't thinking of the party in the evening or his family. He gave everything to his work. When he went home, he gave everything to his family, forgot about the work. When he slept, he gave sleep and everything he got. He never worried about what's going to happen next. When he was playing and partying, he played 100%, give everything he got. He said it was the secret of a happy life. Whatever you do, give it everything you've got. And I mentioned that in the temple, West End Temple, Mississauga, when they were collecting donations. And I mention that here too. When you're making a donation, give it everything you've got. Ajahn Brahm, is it a sin to end life of a person if on support system, especially if it is your parents? It is not your right to end anybody else's life, but it is your right to convey their wishes. This is a practical, it's not the first time I answer these questions. Many people, their mother, their father, maybe on life support,
The doctor in the hospital comes up to you as the senior relative, maybe the eldest son, and tells you, your mother has no chance of survival, can I switch off the life support? What should you do? What you should do, and what works every time, is to spend a few minutes alone by that mother or that father, hold their hand, and feel if they're still there. Ask them, are you still there, Mom? Dad? You will know. You know there's somebody left, or whether they've already gone. You're a child of that mother. You have a connection with them. You only need to ask that question. It's not psychic powers, it's basic intuition. The same process if your daughter, say in New York, has an accident in Toronto, you know it here, something's wrong with her. You feel it. That's such a common thing, a connection between people you love. What you need to do is to ask that question. You know they're there or they're not there. Sometimes I do that for the family. Remember this Vietnamese man? He was on the edge of life and death after a bypass for about 4 or 5 days. He was really struggling. So I went to visit about 3 or 4 times every day. And then I went there one afternoon, sat by him. It was different. He'd gone. You could feel it. There was no person inside anymore. And so I told him, look, he's gone. I always remember that the doctor and the nurse next to me, they knew because they had the experience. But I didn't have to be a doctor, I knew the person had gone. I said, look, you can turn off the life support system now. There's no one there anymore. They've died. Stream of consciousness has left the body, they're gone. All you're doing is just turning off a dead body. You're not killing them, they're already dead. And you can do that, but if you're sitting next to that person, and you feel, no, there's somebody there, so give them another day. That was another example. A woman told me that she was in a coma for many days. The doctor told the children, there's no hope of your mother's survival. But she was there. Interestingly, she was in Singapore. She said she was in this very dark space, didn't know for how long. What brought her out was what she described as a tinkle of a temple bell. It's always sound is the last thing which a person hears and the first thing which takes them out from the coma. So get a bell, think of, talk to them. Not touch, but sound is what can bring you out from the coma. And then she was back in her body, but she could not speak. She couldn't even squeeze someone's hand or move the eyelid. That part of her brain was still not functioning, but she could hear. And she told me, because she came out of the coma later on, she heard the doctor ask her sons, can we have your permission to turn the life support off? And the sons, like being, this is Chinese tradition, it has to be the sons, they said, eldest son, it's your responsibility. He said, no, I can't make the decision, you help me. He said, no, it's yours. And the eldest son was very upset that the decision was left to him. And the mother was listening to the conversation. And she said, son, I'm still here. Please don't turn it off. Don't turn it off. And then he said, don't turn it off. He got the message. One day later, she started to move. And she made a full recovery, you know, from that coma. And she goes around to Buddhist conferences talking about her experience, what it's like, and what brought her out, and how the doctors, they don't know sometimes. You have to be next to them. You will know if that's your mum or dad. Ask the question. And if it's very clear to you, there's no one left. You are not killing your mum or father. They're already dead. You're just turning off an empty shell. The driver has left the vehicle. You're just turning off the engine. That's all. That's how you should do it. If you think there's somebody there, another day, please. It's amazing how many times they come back. So hopefully that answers the question on that. And it's practical, it does actually work. Many people have done that. Yes? And feelings are telling the truth. You will know that because this is important. You really pay attention when it's life and death matters. It's amazing just how such matters clear the mind. You won't be thinking of dinner when you're making that decision. You won't be trying to think of who won the election in the United States.
when your mother's in hospital. You are naturally clear when a very important decision has to be made. And what you feel is usually the truth. And that's what to trust. Ajahn, you tell us to be compassionate, to let go. How do you deal with the problem that when you are like that, some people take advantage of you and consider you submissive? Yes, take advantage of me. You've been taking advantage of me for the last 3 days. Making me give all these talks up to late at night, photographs of Buddhist, but I'm very happy. That's my job in life, to be taken advantage of. But if you're submissive, there's a story of the bad snake. This is adapted from a Jatakatha. Once upon a time, there was a very bad snake. He was mean. He was vicious. He was bad. He was one bad dude snake. He would bite people. He wasn't attacked, he was just biting them for fun. That was his fun, not the people who were bitten's fun. So when people knew about this very vicious and mean and bad aggressive snake, they knew where he lived, so they'd always make a big detour. But one day, the bad snake, getting old, he started to think, what happens to snakes when they die? Do snakes get reincarnated? Or do they just disappear at the end of their life? He started to get, in his old age, religious. And he always heard that not far away there was this holy snake who gave talks in this Buddhist temple. So one day he decided just to go and have a listen, just to see. But because he had a reputation of being bad and vicious and mean, he had to go in disguise. So he put on a hat, a raincoat and dark glasses, and he crept to the vihara at a time when a monk from overseas was giving a talk. And so he just stood by the door instead of coming in, so no one recognized him, and so he could make a quick getaway if he didn't like it. But when the bad snake was listening to the monk, you know, what the monk said made a lot of sense. So first of all he was interested, then he became convinced. And by the end of the sermon, the bad snake was converted. He took off his glasses and coat. He went, look up, who's come to the temple? This really mean bad snake. And he came up to the holy snake. He said, I've been bad and mean for my whole life. I've done a terrible life and I want to make amends. Please tell me what to do. So the holy snake said, from now on you must keep the 5 precepts. So I'll keep the 5 precepts. He said, you know what they are? Not yet, but I'll keep the 5 precepts. And so from now on you must not kill anyone, no biting, okay? Yes. So he went away and reformed and converted his snake. And he gave a donation in the box as he went up. He gave a coin donation. You know why people like giving coins? So you can hear them making a donation. Those don't make any noise. So he went back to stay where he usually stayed, but now he was converted. He was keeping the 5 precepts. He even became a vegetarian as well. He joined Amnesty International, had a big Amnesty International. It was totally changed environmentally, Greenpeace as well, made a subscription to Greenpeace. It was a totally changed snake. But people didn't know that, because he can't speak. So people still were afraid of that snake, until one day someone was listening to an Ajahn Brahm talk on their iPod, and they walked right past that snake. And the snake never bit. And from that time on, people started to realize this was not a dangerous snake anymore. So people didn't worry about the snake. But there's always some bad children, usually boys, who take advantage of what they think are submissive people. They realized this snake was not going to bite. So they started shouting at that snake. You namby-pamby cream puff of a snake. You've got no guts anymore. You're just an oversized worm. That's what you are. You're not a real snake. You're just a slimy creep. Calling a snake a slimy creep actually is quite true. But nevertheless, it's not nice for a snake to hear. And that was a very proud snake. It didn't like to be calling bad things. And the snake thought, can you bite one of them, just one of them, to show them I'm a real snake and I've got power.
But he couldn't do that because of five precepts. So the boy is starting to pick up sticks and stones and throw them at that snake. Some of them hit and they really hurt. And because the snake couldn't defend himself, they came even closer and beat him over the back with the sticks. The snake had to take that beating. But he realized, in real life, you can't be kind. In real life, you can't keep precepts. You've got to defend yourself. So after taking that beating, he painfully crawled to the Mahavihara again to be released from his five precepts. And as he came in the door, the holy snake from Australia saw him. What's happened to you, bad snake? It's your fault. You gave me the five precepts. Look what happened to me. If I'm kind and compassionate, people walk all over me. They treat me like a doormat. They don't respect me anymore. I've come here to be released from my five precepts so I can bite back. And the monk said, oh, you stupid snake. You idiot snake. You ignorant snake. It's true I gave the five precepts, which means you can't bite. But it doesn't mean you can't hiss. And that's all a snake needs to do to defend themselves. And people run away. So to be compassionate and kind, please don't bite or punch or scold. But as a Buddhist, you are allowed to hiss. And that was meaning you don't get taken advantage of. That's the story of the bad snake, which shows you, yeah, you can be kind, you can keep precepts, but you can also be safe as well. So please, yes. Wives are very good at that. Husbands too. And that means you're not taking advantage of. Because you count too. As being kind to yourself. Any other questions, or is it time to go?
Last question,
yes.
I volunteer at a hospice, a palliative care, and I have a client who is 41 years old, and he's paralyzed. He has ALS from neck down. So what do you think of euthanasia? Because his wife is...
Okay. Youth in Asia is not the problem. It's youth all over the world. Sorry for that. What's euthanasia? Euthanasia means a good death. So if it is involuntary euthanasia, that's fraught with so many problems. Sometimes you think you're putting them out of their misery. Most times you're putting them out of your own misery. You can't stand the suffering. It has to be that person's choice. We are the owner of our karma, heir to our karma. It is our choice. So when it's euthanasia, I make a great distinction between voluntary euthanasia and euthanasia. Voluntary euthanasia is where the person makes their own choice. Without coercion, with a very clear mind. In Australia, there was one man called Dr. Nitschke who performed the first legally sanctioned voluntary euthanasia in Darwin, in Australia, some years ago, on a fellow called Mr. Dent, who was a Buddhist. In the history of our world, a Buddhist received the first legally sanctioned voluntary euthanasia some years ago. I never met Mr. Dent, one of my monks did. The reason why he chose that, he was also in a vegetative state, which could last for years, and his wife had to look after him 24 hours a day. Yes, she did get respite, but she had no life apart from looking after her husband. And he told this monk he wanted to do voluntary euthanasia, not for himself, out of compassion for his wife, to free her so she can live a life. And that was his one reason. In order to perform voluntary euthanasia, he had to go through stringent medical and psychological tests, first of all, to make sure, yes, the disease he had no reasonable chance of any cure. Number two, that he had no coercion at all. There was no siblings waiting for the inheritance. There was no sense of guilt he had to do this. It was a very clear and free choice. And that he was in his right mind and not suffering from depression or any other psychological diseases. When he went through those processes, the doctor hooked him up to an intravenous, into which an inhibitor could be injected to give him a very peaceful and dignified death. And he had a computer screen which he could touch, I think with his nose or something, with the commands. Basically, a long series of questions, which made sure he knew what he was doing, why he was doing it. And he had to pass through many hurdles to show that it was his real free will. And he was going to do this. He wanted to do it without any coercion. He did it. It was a very interesting when you find out what voluntary euthanasia really is, which is why I explained it and why people want to do it. And when he did that, as far as I was concerned, you could see no bad karma in that at all. It was very well done. He took control of his life and death. No one else did. He wasn't encouraged. He wasn't stopped. It was his choice. And it is for each one of us. And that solves an ethical problem. Because many people, many of you, would not want to go through the agony and pain of a prolonged illness with no reasonable chance of success. You would not want to put your family through that torture and trauma. Nor, obviously, just waste the resources of, you know, hospitals which are really strapped for cash. Ethically, I say that is fine. It's your choice. I can't tell you to do it. No one can tell you to do it. It's your choice. And I think we should give people the opportunity to make that choice. And take away the lawyers and politicians who mess things up. And for those Buddhists who say, no, they must have some karma they have to wear off by going through that final illness. I say, yeah, sure. Just like you've got a broken leg. You think, oh, I've broken my leg. I mustn't call the doctor and get it fixed up. There's some karma I have to endure. If you've got a broken leg, I would call the doctor and get it fixed up. I'm not saying this is some pain I have to endure because of karma I don't understand. If you can do something to relieve suffering, in Buddhism you do. So I even wrote to the Australian government when the voluntary euthanasia laws came in, spoke for it, supported it on behalf of the Buddhist community in Australia, and said voluntary euthanasia should be allowed. There's nothing wrong with that according to Buddhist principles. Do you think it's bad? In ethics, there's a very good rule of thumb where some of that light comes up to feel what it's like in your heart. Does that feel bad? Does that feel wrong? If it doesn't feel bad, if it doesn't feel wrong, it usually is not wrong. You know, killing someone else, giving them an injection, you ask any doctor or nurse, they just don't like doing that at all. It feels wrong. And the reason is because it is wrong. It's amazing, the human being, when we take away religion, when we take away laws, and instead we feel it in our heart, that's usually 100% correct. When religion gets involved, it confuses you. You're going to go to hell, that's wrong, you're going to go to jail for that. It confuses, so you're not really sure what's right and what's wrong. Take all that away, trust your heart, you usually always do the right thing. So that's euthanasia. And it's great you ask these questions, and hopefully the Buddhist monks ask them directly. They don't quote the suttas. It says this in there, that's just hiding. Interpret the sutras, tell it as it is, and I know those sutras, I know that vinaya backwards, and I also know that this is what's ethical and this is what's not. And it makes Buddhism a practical religion which frees you to make compassionate, ethical decisions. Something I often say, never allow your learning to stand in the way of the truth. Too often the learning, what you've heard, what you've read, what you believe, that's one thing, and what you know is truth is sometimes another thing. Always bend your faith. Change your faith to fit the truth. Don't change the truth to fit your faith. changing the truth to fit your faith. Many religions do that, including some parts of Buddhism. They know it can't be right, but the book says so, therefore it must be right. No. Bend your faith to fit the truth. And that is real Buddhism. Okay. So that's enough for tonight. If you want some more, you'll have to come. Thorstein? It's not that far. Or anyway, there's other monks, good nuns who come here. So please support the temple. Please have a good life. If you want some more, you can always get on YouTube every Friday when I'm not overseas. So thank you. Oh, we've got announcements. Okay. Closing announcement. Okay, if you're going to do sadhu. That. Can I have this back in? That's terrible. When you're doing something, give it everything you've got. Sadhu. 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 Doesn't that make you happier? Okay, one more time. Sadhu. Sadhu.